Okay, so welcome newbies or science journalism folk, etc., to this little sequence where we're going to combine both popular culture in terms of the film Arrival and also I'm going to attempt to cram a whole couple of centuries worth of science fiction and the way it's kind of relative to the science journalism course into about 50 minutes. Can it be done? Of course it can be done, because as Albert Einstein said in a quote that I'll come back to at later part of this particular piece, the most persistent, stubborn illusion is that there's a difference between past, present, and future. Everything's happening at the same time. This is nothing new. This is something that's been speculated about since the 13th century with the Mappa Mundi, the whole notion of the map of the world, the totality of everything, the totality of the universe. Stephen Hawking looking down now at the same time as he's being born, he's writing his theory of everything, and so on and so forth. Hence the reason I've called it Approaching Singularity, because there is a sense that in many ways from a psychology's perspective, and indeed many cosmologists are coming around to this thought as well, the way in which we perceive time is just an illusion. It's just something which we happen to sort of experience on the basis of moving on a linear process through time. And one of the things that the movie we're going to see, Arrival, does is play with that, and it also plays very solidly with language as well. So, a bit of backstory in terms of where do we get this thing called science fiction from? Well, that was Hugo Gernsback's approach in terms of what he was referring to. And as you can see there, about 90 years ago, a little over, he sees the whole process as basically being a bit like a scientific romance. A kind of adventure story, a tale. Any science fiction folk around will be interested. Hugo Gernsback actually gave his name to the Academy Awards of Science Fiction Writing, which would be the Hugo Awards. Okay, and there are lots and lots of definitions of what science fiction is, how it relates to folk, how it connects. If there were time and I went around everybody in the room and said, what science fiction mean to you? We guarantee you'd get people say Star Wars, Doctor Who, ray guns, bug-eyed monsters, aliens, time ships, genetic engineering, the whole lot. Ultimately, it's about thought experiments. As I say, that whole notion that everything is occurring simultaneously. And what if that is the case? You know, how do we relate to that? That actually, time is an illusion. Nobody can ever be late, nobody can be on time, because everything is happening at the same precise moment. Right. Gary's always fashionably, so yeah, I'm not on time for the whole thing, so it's an excuse for that perspective.
Thank you for drawing his
attention. So, in terms of the whole system, let's go back to that defining sort of line. What do we mean if we're writing for New Scientist or we're writing for Scientific American? What does this term science fiction actually refer to? Well, there's another definition. And again, it plays around with the notion of time, a diachronic medium, something where we can actually see a progress. We kind of sense that actually we now have devices like this, which can have a whole world of entertainment at our fingertips. Arthur C. Clarke never envisaged this. He kind of saw computers with IBM, some massive things filling at least the size of this room, if not beyond. And those are notions of portable screen-saving devices, not necessarily sort of in the frame of things. But people often say, yes, science fiction, great prediction. It's not just about prediction. You could argue if you take that timeline, but actually it's just simply people remembering the future. Remembering the future. Okay. And actually I'm really pleased this is happening in medieval week, because as I said at the start, one of the things about medievalism is that a lot of the thoughts and writings of Thomas Aquinas are hardcore science fiction. And they're also echoed by the likes of David Mitchell in Cloud Atlas and in the movie we're going to see today, in terms of how we relate to the other. Even if you look at the map of the worlds and the lines that are actually there, the notion that the wall that surrounds the Earth, beyond there we actually have the Magog and Magog. We have the aliens. We have the bug-eyed monsters, the manifestations of fear and things. Quick question for you. Have you heard of the Antipodes? Australia and New Zealand, often referred to as going to the Antipodes. Somehow. Right, next question. Do you know why they're actually called the Antipodes? Because in the early map-making scenario where not everybody thought the world was flat, but in this notion of going beyond and in the time, pre-Captain Cook, obviously, there was the sense that if you're on the other side of the sphere, you would work backwards. So it's antipodal. You actually sort of reverse your sort of way. They are actually on the other side. Anti, the opposite, pod, pod, the way backwards. The reason I raise that is because in the movie we're about to see, pod is particularly interesting because we're talking about aliens who are heptapods, seven-footed beings, who are also then anthropomorphized into Abbott and Costello, because it's a case of how do we actually start understanding them, how do we work through that whole notion. So, as we said, this whole notion of each step, pod, notwithstanding, etc., is very much in place from that. James Donald, in his text Fantasy in the Cinema, which is obviously at the heart of what you could arguably say in terms of cinema and contemporary journalism, one of the most prolific and influential art forms of the 20th and 21st century, we're still heading well into that, is actually the way in which you get this mixture of things occurring. We started off in the Journalism and Contemporary Cinema class by looking at Luc Besson's Valerian and City of a Thousand Planets, which is space opera, which is adventure, which is romance, and so on. In other words, it's a mixture of genres. You've got that connection together, and that's what effectively opens up the stories and the message. And stories, again, are critical to this whole notion of how we understand science fiction. You take the world's longest-running magazine of cult entertainment, Starburst, and you get front covers featuring the likes of the new incarnation of Lara Croft, Assassin's Creed, and so on. Fundamentally, it's the story that the characters go through that hooks us into a particular piece or leaves us cold, depending on sort of what aspect is there. Last year in this session, we actually used the Robert Zemeckis film Contact with Jodie Foster. Again, that sort of whole notion of first contact and beginning to understand what is out there, how things are related, and so on. This time around, it's a little bit more explicit in terms of the alien contact, and it comes from a different area. In the words of Denis Villeneuve, the director of Arrival, this is his attempt at dirty science fiction. That's not a euphemism for an adult movie that we're going to screen, no, but it is something which basically, in his own words, is the sort of feel of image that you get on a wet, dingy, dull Tuesday afternoon where you're looking, peering through the clouds, and suddenly you see these things begin to emerge. That's the line he was taking. This was the first science fiction movie that he has actually done. He then went on, of course, on the success of Arrival to also sign up straight away to do Blade Runner 2049. And again, has been flagged up as a sort of visionary in terms of the images and lines that he's taken for that. So, go back to the origins. It's interesting that when she wrote it, she couldn't actually say it was Mary Shelley, because young ladies in 1818 did not write novels. It was not the done thing. Good grief. You'll be wanting to be the educator next. It's outrageous. So it actually wasn't until sort of latterly that effectively the fact that it was a woman who kicked off the whole notion of science fiction and actually writing something which reflects on society, its fears, its concerns. And you could actually do a really effective analysis in terms of content analysis, etc., of how often Frankenstein foods, genetic engineering, Frankenstein monsters, and so on, actually take part in our common language of scientific writing. It's a great headliner. It's a way of actually grabbing people's attention and so on. For every concern about electricity and what's happening taking place, the French, God bless them, also come up with various other things. This travel, the whole notion of actually one of the things about science fiction is it's new worlds, it's new frontiers. It's discovering a whole range of new aspects, maybe outer space, maybe on our own world, maybe heading to the centre of the world, and so on. And even to the whole notion of Labovitz there talking about the whole notion of where do we all start from? This Big Bang theory. We'll talk a little bit more about how memory operates, because memory and time also connected together. And the current theory suggests that actually in order to remember things, it's getting in touch with low entropy states to high entropy states. I'll explain that in a few moments, but again, it's a way in which we kind of keep a handle on what's around. And this whole notion of time, I mean, Mark Twain's line in terms of a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court Somebody effectively bumps their head, wakes up, and they're back in the era of Camelot. And they have an impact and lines from that. And that's, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's Back to the Future, doesn't matter whether it's Doctor Who, it's any of those kind of notions of saying what would happen if we put so-and-so in this particular environment and so on. How would they relate? How would they connect? And so on. And of course, you might well say one of the granddaddies of them all, Herbert George Wells, influenced by the likes when he studied at a university after having had a mixed career as a failed draper's assistant and decided actually to do some education by the likes of Aldous Huxley, by the likes of Charles Darwin and the lines and the views of that in terms of natural selection. And The Time Machine in many ways is a wonderful, relatively short novella which actually projects ahead and says what happens if humanity splits into two particular species or subspecies. The Morlocks, the people who live underground, who have a technological drive and desire, or the folk who effectively are the Eloi, who apparently are living wonderfully well until we find out that actually they're simply sacrificial lambs for the Morlocks. How do we develop? Actually, there's a wonderful sequel to The Time Machine, written by Stephen Baxter, on the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the publication in 1995, which is still available, called The Time Ships. It's a lot bigger than The Time Machine, but Baxter, because he's a huge fan of Wells and indeed a whole range of other aspects, has done that. A couple of years ago he also wrote a sequel to The War of the Worlds, so he kind of updates it and looks at various other sort of elements within that, and he's also a very good hard scientific writer in his own field as well, in terms of aspects of science and popularizing science as well. And even that whole notion of the creator of Tarzan and Under the Moons of Mars, Old Barsoom and John Carter of Mars, a movie which many people said was the worst one ever made. I should probably screen it in one way, shape or form, but again, it ties into that whole notion of travel and so on. So I'm not going to spend too much on the literary side of things here, but I want to pick out two sort of key things here. Darko Suvan talks about the novum, N-O-V-U-M. In his definition of science fiction, Suvan effectively says one of the things that makes science fiction is it's about something new, something which is unexpected. It's an anomaly. It also makes the audience kind of think, what? What the flip? What is that all about then? You know, a seven-footed species, creature and so on, how does that connect? Is it surrealism? I used a line earlier today, which I still quite like actually, even though you might say, what? How many surrealists does it take to change a light bulb? A fish. So it shows that sort of on the real and the kind of notion of actually separating out what we see, what things are connected, etc. It's part of the pleasure of science fiction. It's part of actually experiencing like the wow factor. The first time you see Star Wars and this huge, massive spaceship comes across and all those kind of elements that are connected. Now, you might well say, yeah, and that's science fiction. All special effects, no plot. Some science fiction is like that. Some less so. Some actually starts dealing with the human aspects and so on. And ultimately you get in science fiction this whole notion of speculation. What is possible? What would happen if the swans in Brayford could actually talk? Would they want to sign up for a university course? Of course they would. They're desperately keen there. Maybe they're actually already chilled out in their own platter. I don't want to be specious, but who knows what could happen in terms of lines for that. There's Darko Suvam's line. Other themes and narrative preoccupations pretty much come along as follows. And this is where we get into what is the interesting field of science philosophy, or sci-fi. See, I did that. Excellent. It's often argued that way back in the time of Plato and Socrates, and if you've read Plato's Republic, you might recall the notion of Plato's cave and the line that he used there, that in the cave, the inhabitant of the cave had been there since birth, and what they experience as reality is simply the flickering shadows of lights projected on the wall. So that's all they ever know. Fast forward a couple of thousand years, and that's exactly what the plot of The Matrix is all about. It's about Plato's allegory of the cave and enlightenment, or breaking free of the chains that surround us and effectively sort of moving on from there. And clearly the Wachowski brothers, as they were, Wachowski sisters now, had kind of looked in The Matrix to develop the whole aspect of not only biblical narrative and the notion of Neo, Keanu Reeves' character, Thomas Anderson played as the one superheroic messiah that comes through, but also breaking free from that world in which human beings serve only to experience the unconscious. The notion of waking up from that unconscious and realizing that we're not just at the behest of a grand illusion, a grand fiction that comes through. And that whole notion of the nature of reality, what do we mean by reality? It doesn't matter whether you're Friedrich Nietzsche and you're talking about the agonies of that, or indeed you are the creator of Cartesian mathematics and you've sorted out what a y-axis is, what an x-axis is, and you actually have Cartesian named after you because your name is René Descartes and you want to speculate on the meaning of existence. So does anybody know what René Descartes' classic little mantra was? Translates from the Latin, from cogito ergo sum, which means,
I think, before spot on.
That's well done. It's rocking and rolling today. He shoots, he scores. I think, therefore, I am. How do you actually, what else is something like Ex Machina? What else is any of the so iRobot, Will Smith, etc., than trying to distinguish how do robots differ from human beings? Carol Chapek in Rossum's Universal Robots in 1921 was writing very much about the whole notion of a slave race. Interesting, returning to medievalism, I hadn't realised until this week that actually the reason people living in Wales hate English folk referring to them as the Welsh is because Welsh translates from a rooted word meaning slave. Because actually, back in the Middle Ages, that's how people actually viewed the Welsh. They were slaves. So that's the sort of connections there. And the danger, again, of language, understanding it, getting it wrong. It's all about that whole notion of love of knowledge, philosophy, how we develop it and how we work through that process. And this gentleman, well, maybe we'll say he's full of it, Philip Kindred Dick, responsible for a whole heap of science fiction theories and thoughts and texts, which basically were poo-poo, unfilmable, until Ridley Scott finally decided to seize the bull by the horns and produce something which is completely different from Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, but actually became Blade Runner and opened the way for Hollywood to have a whole range of Philip K. Dick programs, including a series on Channel 4. I mean, sadly, Dick actually passed away, transcended, in 1982, just as Blade Runner was about to be released. And first time around, it was a critical flop. People said, this is rubbish. It's just basically hardboiled detective fiction set up in a system which doesn't work at all. And yet already we got a connection with Denis Villeneuve doing the sequel, the almost unfilmable sequel to Blade Runner, Blade Runner 2049. And Dick's sort of views, again, you can argue his own perspective, but he actually swore to his end. It may well have been because he was experimenting with psychedelic and psychotropic substances and so on, but he maintained this was just an illusion we were living in. The Romans were still in charge, and basically the water was drugged, and therefore the vast alien life force intelligence network, or VALIS, which was his last novel, was basically in charge and running it. Again, Alan Turing had his own demons, had his own challenges, etc., broke the Enigma Code, and then effectively took his own life, because again, of people's perceptions and various other aspects. That's mentioned in Ex Machina, more than mentioned, actually, it's at the heart. How can you tell, scientifically, whether the person that you're speaking to is human and not a machine or an android? And do we care? In an era where actually care homes are finding that actually more senior citizens are relating better to artificial android forms and robots, where does that place us as a society? How do we connect on that basis? Do we mind? Or are we creating another slave race of robots who ultimately are destined to rise against us? Oh no. And then other writers, the likes of Ursula K. Le Guin, who actually went to the same school as Philip K. Dick. They actually met each other, but they were sort of contemporaries. Ursula has passed away, sadly, this year. Current contemporary writers, Margaret Atwood, the likes of Naomi Alderman, they start talking again a mixture about the sort of notion of the inner space is as important as outer space. So you have a mixture of both. Until you can actually know what happens from within, you can't really extrapolate to what goes without. It's one of the reasons Fritjof Capra wrote a text which effectively related Taoism to cosmology and said that the actual processes that cosmologists and scientists and people working at the CERN particle accelerator area go through is exactly the same as what a Buddhist monk will go through, because they're both searching for the truth. You might be wearing white lab coats or hazmat suits, or you might actually be wearing an orange cloak, or orange outfit, but fundamentally it's that search for truth that is what we're about here. And what we see in terms of, again, hazmat suits in Arrival, again, works through that process. And he had lots of experiments with lightning as well. To a greater or lesser extent, he was a kind of Renaissance man of the 1700s. I mean, you know, he was your go-to chap in America, not only for the fundamental Declaration of Independence and so on, but also because of things that he was involved with. He was, you know, connecting the whole ocean. And again, this strange, bizarre thing called electricity, without which this would be useless, those would be useless, and we basically have to do what Plato and Aristotle actually used to do, and actually teach you wandering around the campus, which might be fun, peripatetic teaching. Next stage forward, I shall suggest that, the next sort of luck. How do we get to some of the key themes, some of the big high concept stuff that's around there? Does anybody know what that acronym stands for? Because it is an acronym, like ostrich, outrageous suggestions taken readily in courageous hands. But this is SETI. What is SETI? As opposed to SETI, which is what you sit on in the north.
What is the first letter?
Search. Search. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Set up by Carl Sagan. Still in operation, although they're regularly talking about, have we not found them yet? 15 years, we've found lots of planets. Stacks of planets. Actually, in the 18 years that Sci-Fi London Film Festival has been running, it's heading to its 19th year now, there have been over 5,000 Earth-type planets discovered around the galaxy with respect to the Hubble Space Administration and so on, and sort of lines. This was at a time, a few years ago, people said, no, there aren't any planets. But then, a few hundred years ago, well, of course the Earth's flat. And of course the Sun revolves around the Earth, doesn't it? Time travel, artificial intelligence, space exploration, and there's a nice one to actually sort of chew on at the end of the session today. What's it all about in any case? Why are we here? Why have we chosen to be here? What's the purpose of being here? Are we actually, as carbon-based life forms, unique? How is it that basically, you know, with our DNA effectively being very similar, apart from 3 or 4% to your average kangaroo, where do things differ? How do we connect? Have we, as suggested by Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick, been explored? Are we experimented on by extraterrestrial intelligence? Are people, you know, taking it, etc., etc.? It's often said that actually the first science fiction text is the Bible, basic instruction booklet for the life experience. And you've got stacks of areas within that in terms of ways that you're dealing from inputs and elements as well. Okay. So let's move on now to the movie itself and also some other generic themes that we get within that. Now, Arrival has got a massive one of these. The most popular one that's regularly churned out is, what about the grandfather paradox? Does anybody know what a grandfather paradox is, or grandparent paradox?
So that you could be your own grandparent.
Yes, or you could go back in time, prevent your grandparents from ever meeting, and how would you exist to go back in time? It's the Back to the Future quandary.
I hate that.
Exactly. Yeah, well, there we are.
It's such a great thing. I was like, you can't go back and then go back.
We've got
to
different reality.
Yeah. I hate it.
Back and back. And so, of course, one of the solutions that have been put forward, quite an elegant one, I think, is actually every decision that you make has got an equal and opposite decision. So you splinter off a whole series of different realities. And so that kind of encompasses a sort of multiverse of opportunities that's actually there. Probably best evinced by Gwyneth Paltrow in Sliding Doors, which again sort of echoes that particular line of things, etc. Again, on the one hand, we find out more about ourselves by having an alien to say, well, that's what we're not. But as I said, medieval history and aspects relating to that, you've got Beyond the Wall, Gog and Magog, you've got the aliens, you've got the monsters that are actually there. It's interesting that there are conspiracy theorists who even now maintain, given that Ready Player One is about to launch, that Steven Spielberg is little more than a paid propagandist for alien life forms, who's getting us to kind of get used to those sort of close encounters of the third kind, E.T. and so on, and actually, what's he doing? What's he all relating to that whole side of things? But then, 53% of Americans claim they've been abducted by aliens. There's a message there. 53%. claim that of American citizens surveyed, it used to be, I think, around about 66, 67, but now it's just 53% who believe in alien abduction. So,
they forget, yeah.
Progress. Yeah, well, exactly. You know, they clearly sort of have their mind. And yet, even saying that, actually, what am I doing? I'm basically saying the Americans, I'm kind of already sort of saying, we're not Americans, we are thou, it's an alien perspective, Americans are the other. So you're already kind of setting up that sort of line where you think, hang on, what? Where's he, what's he saying, etc.
With the time travel paradox, isn't it, is it like impossible to go back in time scientifically and kind of go forward?
Check out Time's Arrow.
Time isn't real, so you can't do it.
If there is one sequence that comes through, which I'll alert you to in a slide in a few moments, in which there's a lovely nod in the direction of Time's Arrow and how actually travel backwards has been viewed as a theoretical possibility. Anyway, let's draw ourselves together because I've got to pack in quite a lot, as I said, and we're sort of driving through on that basis. Couple of key things there, which many people, when they start talking about the scientific method, are very keen to promote. It's all about being precise, empirical data, objective data, not just actually make a decision on the basis of what it felt like it. When Gregor Mendel was actually gathering his pea seedlings together and exploring heterozygotes with his homozygotes and doing the fundamental research that led Crick and Watson to discover the double helix and the genome project and so on, he was very clear and very diligent in keeping all his results precisely sorted through. And that whole notion of scientific rigor. Things occur because we can predict that they will occur again, not because the gods wish them so. We actually have a series of things where people say, oh yes, but what about all this new age therapy, etc.? Well, again, what's your choice? Sometimes you make a decision for health reasons or for other reasons. Do you put your trust, do you put your faith in the technology, in the machine, the scientific method, or not? And ultimately, it's up to the individual as to where they go on that particular process. But it is something where oftentimes we're seeing we've got a sort of scientific rigor about this. Everything's database, number crunching, etc. And in many ways, that whole notion of number crunching, the binary world in which we live in, the digital world, is at the heart of huge successes, but also huge misery. Because again, as the movie Gattaca says, what happens if, yes, you can have designer children, why would you not? If you're having a child, want to have the best possible child going, or give them the best chance of life. Does that then mean that effectively any minor differences, like maybe Stephen Hawking possibly had, I'm sorry, you're invalid, it's time to end your existence. Lots of debates in terms of where that comes from and how things develop, etc. And I put in a Star Trek reference here because actually the whole notion of Kirk versus the computer echoed in Star Trek, as indeed Star Trek The Next Generation, and indeed Deep Space Nine has also touched base on a number of things, including the whole element relating to worlds which are similar to ours, but not quite. I'll refer back to Philip K. Dick, The Man in the High Castle. Series, it's on Amazon Prime, available for all sorts of things. All Dick actually does in Man in the High Castle is says what happens, or what would have happened, if the Nazis had actually developed the nuclear bomb first. If the saboteurs of Norway hadn't succeeded and actually heavy water was part of the experiment, they'd had V2 rockets, the whole history scenario would have changed substantially. You might also say, yeah, and equally, it was people like Wernher von Braun who were working for the Nazi party at the time and the Nazi organization to develop the V2 rockets, who then were taken over by the Americans and the Russians, and basically there was a split there which actually led to the space race. And they were both influenced again by the Russian writer Konstantin Tsiolkovsky with his rocket ships and so on. Whoa, rocket ships, and suddenly it's the Rorschach test, and it's a slide from Arrival, and what the hell's this then? Well, quite rightly, what is it? It's unreal. It could be an inkblot. It could be rather like a squid squirting stuff at a screen and so on. We can just make out here the two alien forms, the two heptapods that are actually around in terms of the sequence. And we already see at this time that Louise, played by Amy Adams, has effectively she's got rid of her hazmat suit. She's actually stepped out of this notion which was protecting her in a limited way, which Jeremy Renner, of course. I mean, you've got Lois Lane and you've got Hawkeye. What's not to love about, you know, the fantastic world of Arrival, etc.? and the Bourne of Supremacy, of course. But there's this notion of what does it actually mean? How do you connect? It's what the flip. Seeing something, engaging with it, and seeing where things are going. Okay. Has anybody ever heard of Edward and Benjamin, otherwise known as Sapir and Whorf? No, you see, this is it. I mean, they are linguists. They were linguists, actually. And they also investigated the ancient Hopi language of North America. And their conclusion, which is referred to as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, and yes, there was a connection with Star Trek Next Generation without the H, where the Klingon Whorf is actually named after Benjamin Whorf in terms of an alien language and Klingon language, etc. And that was their conclusion, latter part of 20th century. If you want to actually understand the mind of Vladimir Putin, you've got to learn Russian. You've got to actually appreciate what Russian is about and what sort of metaphor is that. You want to understand the Chinese government, you've got to learn Chinese. You've got to really be able to soak yourself up completely in that language. You want to find out what the ancient Greeks were about, or the Sumerians, or the Babylonians, you need to have some kind of common ground which enables you to translate. Everybody in this room is listening ostensibly to me in English. Some people might be saying it's blah, 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 blah. Other folk might say, but it's ultimately how we kind of work through that. Now, language changes, it evolves, we have different types, different forms of language, we have computer language, we have binary language, we have a plurality. You know, as many people say, oh, we're losing languages, etc. It's constantly changing, it's constantly flowing, it's constantly mutating in terms of where things go. But actually immersing yourself in language on a cognitive level, even if it's science fiction, the more you do, the more you can become soaked up in terms of that particular element and so on. So, where does that relate to? When you see this on screen, right above that question, which Louise, or heroine, effectively sort of writes through, is actually the equation for Time's Arrow. It's very messy, but if you freeze it, you can see it actually developed. So again, there's thought gone into, hang on, what are they doing in this particular aspect? It's interesting insofar as, again, you could say from criticism, oh yeah, and obviously we focus on the alien ship that's over America, blah, 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 etc. But there is an attempt to say there are 12 slices, if you like, that appear across the globe. I think in England it's around about Devon or Cornwall, where you actually see the map sort of appear and so on. But why are they here? Well, actually, the very question that we actually ask why, it all is down to Augustine and his notion of teleology. Teleological thinking. That actually, what's the end point? What's the end game? What's the thing that we're working towards? As opposed to a kind of ontological, ongoing sequence from that. And again, you're into science, philosophy, and that particular aspect, because you're also dealing with the law of causality. Mostly on planets with gravity, if I do that, you know, it falls to the ground, it falls downwards, it doesn't go up. If we were actually in orbit around the Earth, that would not occur. Things change, systems change, etc. As you've seen, gravity being it floats up. I mean, a lovely shot of Stephen Hawking was when he actually got to experience zero gravity, zero G, and sort of work through that. Again, that whole notion of where things are going. But variational principles per se, again, seem to argue it's a Newtonian world, something happens and we work through that basis. And this is one of the key things that comes across in the movie as well. Now, that's quite a time span, isn't it? I mean, that, 3,000 years from where we are now, and there's, what have we got here? Nothing. I think you've got the back end of the Jurassic period, or there, you're certainly into biblical times and lines from that. You know, so 3,000 years, it's quite a hike. That cosmological clock. How long have human beings actually been a sentient species? Actually, a relatively small time in cosmological time. And we don't know how many other previous civilizations may or may not have existed before us, etc., etc. But again, these strange areas that come to it. Now, in 1950, there was the first science fiction movie which began to address the whole notion of alien contact, which was The Day the Earth Stood Still, which was remade again with Keanu Reeves. Probably not quite as effective. But again, it's coming out as the basis of, at that stage, it's the beginnings of the nuclear age, the beginnings of mutually assured destruction potential. How science, to go back to Mary Shelley's view, can actually be not only an asset, but also a downright liability. It can really impact massively in terms of how we live our lives, sometimes for the better, but sometimes for the worse. Fire, wonderful example, Arthur C. Clarke uses extensively. The notion that fire on the one hand is great, you know, without fire, big problems, but it can be used to destroy. And also, microwaves, you can cook food, you can cook human beings. There are all sorts of other areas that work within that whole notion of problems and so on. And there, again, is one of the key questions that, again, we see consistently with respect to Rome. And I think one of the things, to the credit of the writers and the sort of package team for this, is that they've deliberately gone for that sense of alien nature. It's not flying saucers as such, not that there's anything necessarily wrong with flying saucers, but you are looking at differences and areas within that. And how people react. Do you react by sending out the nuclear missiles? At the end of 2001, A Space Odyssey, if you've ever read the book, based on the Sentinel, or did you see the movie, there's the birth of the Star Child, and the first reaction that in the book happens is that several rockets from both Russia or the Soviet Union and America go up to effectively blow the heck out of it, and it's just wiped away. You don't understand it, you destroy it. It's often said that when the Native Americans first encountered Columbus, they had no conception of what it was they were seeing. And then again, actually, on the other side of the world, we talk about the Antipodes and the shape, the sort of nodes of that. It is unusual. Different cultures have got different areas, different experiences, etc. And isn't this the question that's often asked by many Daily Mail reader or Daily Express reader? They think, yeah, why are these migrants here? Have they come in to take over? Have they come in to change the neighbourhood? Etc., etc. You know, a lovely way in which science fiction is metaphor. It's one of the reasons Gene Roddenberry, Rod Serling, and other writers who were so fed up in terms of the American censorship, the things they weren't allowed to talk about, just as Jonathan Swift had done in Gulliver's Travels, they used science fiction as an allegory, as a metaphor, as a way of commenting on society and saying, this is wrong, but this is what we need to think about. And it's often given one of the pleasures. Now, sometimes you see these things and they're like, rammed home for you in so many ways, but oftentimes it is that message and metaphor of saying, just get yourself thinking about what is happening here. It's the old sort of North American, old Native American setting that, you know, if you want to understand somebody, it's a bit like a language one, walk a mile in their shoes, which time you'll be a mile away from them in their shoes as well, but that's quite advice. Okay. This gentleman wrote Arrival. It's not, I mean, you can find it, you can get the book, it's perfectly acceptable, but do not be fazed when you think, oh, what's this Babylonian tower building got to do with the movie I've just seen? It's a short story. It's a collection of short stories, and one of the things that Ted Chiang, who's a scientist and getting what he was looking to develop in this, again, around about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, was the phrase that he's put there. Take that, that was one of his quotes, and I've even made a typo. Oh, no, it's actually the future and past have equal validity to the present. Okay? Which is where we kind of came in when I suggested the line that Einstein came up with, that ultimately everything is happening simultaneously. Now, on one level, you can say, yeah, of course it is. You can watch Deep Space Nine Emissary, and you can see Benjamin Sisko having difficulty coming to grips with the prophets because the prophets are living life in a non-linear manner. Because people choose to exist wherever they choose to exist. We are here in this room at this particular moment in time at these particular spatial temporal coordinates because that is why at some deep level we've chosen to be. And any notion that actually, you know, we're not also at the same time being born, moving on, transcending, doing a whole range of things is, as Einstein would say in terms of his theory of relativity, just something that, you know, we can't quite deal with. And that's something where, in terms of Arrival, we see that it reveals itself towards the end of the movie. And it reveals itself in terms of the way that the movie is shot. And again, initially, back to think, what? But there is a nice symmetry that's developed in terms of how that's developed and so on. As we see with our heroine there, who, in many ways, if you did a comparison between Louise Banks' character in Arrival with Jodie Foster's character in Contact, there are a number of similarities. except also similarities in terms of loss. But the loss in contact is Jodie Foster's Ellie, I should say. The character Ellie has lost her father. In this case, she has lost her daughter. And yet, there is a twist, which would be a spoiler, which I'll come back to in terms of that. But it's an interesting sort of element which relates to that. So I mentioned that I'd sort of also conclude this opening sort of sequence by talking about this in terms of the third point there. This comes out of current thinking in terms of superstring theory, in terms of where things get to the light, you know, sort of height sort of concept, etc. What is entropy? It's the tendency to disorder. Or as I like to say, the more effort you put into something, the more chaos you cause. Well, it's always explained my cluttered desk anyway. In terms of that whole sort of side of things, actually order and structure is artificial. It involves a lot of effort. And the molecules and electrons and the particles, like other sort of manifestations of those and billions of particles that make up as human beings, we like to exist in the lowest possible entropy states. So from that initial Big Bang, actually, memories, as they're formed, as we continue to form new memories on a day-by-day basis, actually entail an increase in chaos and structure in the way in which they're formed. So to remember things, we almost need to go back to a low entropic manner. And that is the time's arrow sort of line in terms of where people are heading to and so on. Now, the particle accelerator aspect of CERN and this concept of the God particle, I mean, I think it's shut down for a wee while now. And thank God we haven't got a black hole at the center of the Earth as yet. Who knows what could happen. But there was a great fear, I think, at the time when they switched it on that it was going to suck out all sort of reality and things. But that's where people are kind of exploring from the hard scientific viewpoint in terms of what we're seeing and how the Big Bang Theory actually operates, as well as, of course, being a great series that is now into, I think, its 10th or 11th year with Sheldon and others from that point of view. That's not a representation of the Big Bang, but is a representation of a black hole. Faster than light travel, ways in which you actually travel through different universes, ways in which space is folded. How do we actually, science fiction talks about the notion, well, how do we actually get from here to our nearest star, Proxima Centauri? It'll take thousands of years. Light year, the distance that light travels in a year. Light travels at the speed of 186,000 meters per second. That's pretty fast. A lot faster than sound, which is 336 meters per second. But again, those messages of travel and working through that, that's where, God bless him, Stephen Hawking. And I think if you have ever looked at a history of time, which I did back in the 80s, I thought, ooh, that's interesting. This one is actually more user-friendly. It actually kind of starts addressing some of these concepts, which again, from the artistic perspective, you could say, wasn't Salvador Dali doing the same thing with respect to time and the liquid notion and the sort of the clock face that's dissolving? So, actually, yes. You know, ultimately, you are looking at, as Hawking would say, the theory of everything. Everything from the humanities to the arts to the sciences and so on, all connected together to explain that fundamental question, what the flip are we doing here? Humour is always good. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I said check out that particular show in terms of a station that's set up just outside, literally, a black hole and various other things. And in terms of language from the next generation, if you've ever seen the episode of Darmok, these are available on Netflix, people. You can actually look at them if you've got a Netflix account, free of charge, okay? So totally free. So Darmok and Gelada Tanagra, which is the way the Enterprise crew encounter a species who only communicates through terms of metaphor. I'm just suggesting these because I think they serve as initial precursors to areas that we're going to discover, and there we have, obviously, one of the... I think it's the... He's the Chancellor, actually, of the University of Huddersfield. Not him, him. Patrick Stewart. And Darmok and lines from that sort of aspect. Well, that's worthwhile considering. So, that almost brings us around to the movie. Has anybody got any questions on that? As I say, attempt and the ambition was, and it's, yes, 47 minutes since I started, to fit in the totality of the universe into that whole thing. Has that been useful for the point of view of science, journalism, etc.? Hopefully it's provided a kind of a little bit of an input in terms of what we're about to see as well. Come to that. And hopefully there'll be a few moments at the end to actually sort of maybe have a little discussion as well from this point of view. So here, oh, name well, turns this up, is the whole thing.
Yes.